Welcome, everyone. It's very nice to have you here at our Academy of Change Catalyst session with the topic of leadership. And we're delighted to have here with us also six amazing speakers, and I'm really excited to hear more from them in a second. Yeah, before we jump into that, let me just give a very, very brief, well, introduction on why we came together here. We have conducted over the past years the Academy of Change, which is a capacity building program for NGOs from all over the world. And we have conducted two very nice rounds with each 50 NGOs. We were able to get together physically and online several times and discuss all the different aspects of behavior change and how it can support sustainability projects. And well, it has been a unique learning experience, I think, for all of us. And after the experience of finishing the first round of the Academy of Change, we understood that, well, it is important and very valuable to have more understanding and knowledge on how to use behavioral insights and behavior change in general. But that, of course, that does not necessarily lead to a whole organization, well, working with that, applying that knowledge. So because of that, we established the Catalyst program. We invited some selected NGOs to join us there. And the whole idea of the Catalyst program is to support members of NGOs that took part in the training to help them to bring that knowledge to their NGO and to implement it there, to convince their colleagues and so on. So we've had a number of steps there, a number of modules that we went through together, from, well, showing the benefits, how that knowledge would support the work of the NGO, to state why this specific angle is really relevant, how to do it in practice, how to apply it, and also how to sustain it over time. And I think all of these elements resonated well with the NGOs who joined us. However, we also felt there is another additional element to it, which is the leadership skills that one ideally needs to also bring something so new and something maybe sometimes challenging, maybe sometimes time consuming, to bring this into an organization. And this is how we came up with the idea for this session, this little, let's say, bonus model, which of course is not uniquely linked to the topic of behavior change, but just generally can help us to advance any challenges, I guess, we're all facing in the nonprofit sector in advancing with new ideas and in being more impactful in the projects that we implement. So yeah, so that's how we got here. And as said, we are very grateful that you're joining us here and that several of the Academy of Change participants from the first and the second round are also joining us here. I think there's also appetite for sharing some of the learnings also after the session. This is what we heard. I would like to hand over to my lovely colleague, Mariana, who will briefly introduce our speakers and then also lead the discussion with them.
Thanks, Rosa. Welcome, everybody, once again. It's really nice to be here. I'm excited about this session. I'm very excited also about our speakers. So thanks once again to all of our speakers that have accepted our invitation and are here with us. We have this amazing group of people joining us. So starting with Sue Riddlestone, Chief Executive and Co-Founder of BioRegional in the UK, followed by Helen Clarkson, CEO from The Climate Group. We also have Wolfgang Yaman, Executive Director of the International Civil Society Center and also our partner in the Academy of Change. Very happy to welcome also Jen Weidman, Founder and CEO of Space Bangkok in Thailand. We have also Rainer Brockhaus, CEO of the Christian Blind Mission in Germany. And last but not least, Wilhelm Kien, who is the Founder and Managing Director of Govinda, one of the oldest and early vegan food companies in Germany. I would like to start with a brief intro round so I can invite each of you speakers to quickly say in a couple of minutes who you are and what you do. So Sue, would you like to go first and introduce yourself?
Hello everyone, I'm Sue Riddlestone. I'm a chief executive and co-founder of BioRegional, which is a social enterprise based out of the UK but working internationally. We've been going for 25 years and we're a not-for-profit, but as a social enterprise, we take a earning our living point of view and grants to get new things going. And what we're all about is showing, it's all about sustainable living. How can we live well within the natural limits of our planet and leave space for wildlife and wilderness? So we talk a lot about One Planet Living, and that's a framework that we use. And we work mainly in built environments. So I'm speaking here from Bedstead, which is an eco village that we built in London. And we work on other built environment projects, the Olympics in Tanzania, on tourism places, but always with partners. And we also work on sustainable products. So we do a lot of work with some big companies, very much work on changing policy and advocacy, using the examples of our projects to show that it can be done. And so have worked especially on UK policy change and got involved in the UN Rio Plus 20 process and championing the sustainable development goals and helping to get goal 12, sustainable consumption production. Going to all those UN meetings.
Thank you, Sue. Lovely. Helen, would you like to go next?
Hi, thanks. Thanks for inviting me. Yeah, I'm Helen Clarkson. I'm Chief Exec at the Climate Group. We're another nonprofit organization. Our mission is to drive climate action fast. We have sort of our USPs around scale, speed, and collaboration. So we bring together big networks of action with businesses and state and regional governments to reduce emissions in key sectors, energy, transport, industry, the built environment, and trying to get into more into food. So we're about 115 people, I think, last time we looked. We've got offices, our headquarters in London, and we've got offices in New York, New Delhi, and I've got one guy in Beijing. So we're working globally. We are the secretariat of something called the Under Two Coalition, which is state and regional governments around the world committed to climate action. So that takes us lots of places. And then we run these big corporate commitment campaigns. RE100 is the one that more people have heard of, which is around a commitment to renewable electricity. So it's all about sort of markets and policy intersecting and how you really take things to scale.
Wolfgang, how about you going next?
I'm Wolfgang Jammann. I'm currently the executive director of the International Civil Society Center here in Berlin. We're a platform for the leaders of some of the largest international NGOs in the world, Oxfam, Amnesty, Greenpeace, CBM, CARE, and the like. So it's a platform where they get together to collaborate, to find opportunity to work around the big trends that are affecting us. Personally, I've worked for INGOs, international NGOs, in the social impact sector most of my life, my professional life, about 16 years in CEO positions in this sector, which is obviously what you connect most to leadership positions. But I want to qualify this. Actually, when I got my first CEO position in the social impact sector, I had a very smart coach who helped me kind of get my feet on the ground. And the first thing he told me is, don't you think that you're some kind of boss now and that you have anything to say? Very, very smart advice right at the beginning of my leadership career, which really helped me, you know, stay grounded and get prepared for what was expecting me. So thanks for
really cool
doing it here.
Thanks, Wolfgang. Really cool. Thank you. Jen, I'm looking at you.
Yes, sure. And thank you. It's great to be here from the other side of the world. I'm based in Bangkok, Thailand. We work regionally, globally, everywhere. So I'm Jen Weidman. I'm founder and CEO of Space Bangkok, and we are also a social enterprise working in facilitation, peace building, resilience, and training. So our goal is to help those people who are addressing the biggest problems to do their best work. The way that we link into sustainability is more around how can we do our work sustainably over the long term when we're talking about high stress, difficult topics, difficult situations. And that's the resilience piece, which is part of everything we do.
Rainer, would you like to go next?
Sure. I'd love to do that. CBM as an organization, as the name says, Christian Blind Mission, we're focusing on disability inclusive development work. So we're not in the environmentalist sector. Our background, our core focus is disability caused by issues with the eye, impairments of the eye, and that has been extended for the last like 20 years. So the organization is now 112 years old. For the last 20 years, we have extended our topics in terms of size of the organization, roughly 700 people around the globe.
Wow, impressive. Thanks, Rainer. Thank you. Wilhelm, last but not least, would you like to introduce yourself and tell a little bit who you are and what you do?
Yeah, hello to everybody. My name is Wilhelm Kinn, and my leadership started with a vegetarian restaurant like 30 years ago in Heidelberg. And then it was out of a situation that became by accident the leader of a non-profit organization, also in Heidelberg, with around 50 members. And out of this vegetarian restaurant, Govinda came. That's now a company we make, like you say already, vegan food. And that's my issue all over my life. Vegan food, good food, connected with the nature and also connected with a healthy life, mentally, of course, like also bodily.
Super. Okay, so jumping to our questions now and starting really our panel discussion, we'd like to continue still looking to this personal development part of your story before we get into, let's say, more generic and strategic questions. And so on that personal side, and that personal note, we'd like to hear a little bit about your experience. So looking back and then seeing how you started your leadership path, things you have experienced that brought you to where you are today, we would like to hear how this path happened, in if you could share some insights on that. And then looking into that, what surprised you or what you found most challenging or what you found as a game-changing person or moment that really helped shaping your style as you developed afterwards. Jen, when we talked, I enjoyed a lot listening the insights you shared on that aspect, on that note, for various reasons. But interesting facts, you came from the US and you moved to Thailand. Other interesting facts, your family is not, let's say, what we would imagine, an entrepreneurial family, or with like a situation that you would start naturally a path as a leader. So would you like to share a few thoughts on, let's say, a bit on your path and a moment, let's say, of aha or of surprise or of fun or of support that shaped what came afterwards?
Yes, sure. I think a lot of times we see people who are doing their own thing and we think, how did they get there? And sometimes when we look into their stories, we find they had some extra help. So maybe family connections or they had money behind them already. I am not that person. So how do you get to be doing something anyway? For me, I think my leadership journey started before I was in any position of power or any position of supervisory or anything like that in any organization. And actually, I started working at the base level. And at that time, I remember having a lot of bosses. I have had very bad bosses. I've had some good bosses. And I remember thinking, someday I'm going to be a boss. Take note now of what works for me, what doesn't work for me. How can I learn from what I'm experiencing so I know what to do later? Then eventually I got to a program that we were building from nothing, brand new program. And there were a lot of challenges stacked against it. There were some forces and political forces that didn't really want it to succeed. And I was there to make it succeed. I was not actually the head person, but I was the one doing all the work. And in that moment, I realized I can lead this, even though I don't have the position. And so there's a lot of learning around how do you lead from behind? How do you lead from under? How do you lead when you're not the leader or the boss or the supervisor or the person in charge? And you can do it if you're strategic, you can do it if you know the ways to navigate. So for me, that was a big learning about how to do that, both politically in an organization that was very large, had a lot of internal politics and those things. And also interpersonally, when that wasn't my job, but it was my job, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. Fast forward, many things happened. And I was running a program where we were doing a lot of leadership development with people who are working in fields of peace building and conflict resolution. And eventually I thought, you know, I'm ready to do the next step. And that became starting Space Bangkok, which was a big fear place for me. It was very intimidating because I was raised with, you have to look after yourself. Like I said, I don't come from a very privileged background as far as money goes. So you don't leave a job with a stable paycheck to go to something that might not work. In my upbringing, you don't do that. And that's what I had to do. For me, it was one conversation that I had with my mentor, who just looked at me and said, "What are you doing? You've got to get out of here. You've got to do this thing." And she actually, in that moment, she took out $100 from her wallet and she handed it to me. And she said, "Here, you go ask a bunch of us, people you know, like this person and that person, we're all going to give you this money so that you can pay your rent, you can pay your bills while you're starting this thing that you need to do." That moment that someone would actually just do that, and that she believed in what I wanted to do as much, if not more, than I did, was one of those sort of,
I was going to say, if she believed, why wouldn't you, Una?
If she's pushing me so hard, she's emptying her wallet for me right there. How can I not do this? And so I think there are these moments of support along the way. Since then, one of the things that we do is leadership development, actually. And so we walk a lot of paths with a lot of different people about leadership and where they're at and where they want to be, both organizationally and individually and all of that. So I think, you know, in that way, the learning never ends and the learning never should end as a leader. And there's lots to think about and pull in. There are lots of models that work. You have to figure it out for yourself, what works for you, what doesn't work for you. But for my journey, it was a bit of scrappy underdog sort of thing. And I think there's a lot more of us out there than you hear about, because we tend to hear in the media about the flashy side of things, or people who have something else behind them. I've spoken with some other women leaders here in Bangkok, and, you know, given their family connections and things, and they can muster following so quickly. That's harder for the rest of us, but it's okay, because you'll get there.
Thanks, Jan. Thanks for being also so transparent and open about your story and your experience. Sue, is that something that also speaks to you? Is that something where you'd like to share some thoughts about?
Yes, I could feel some real similarities and connections.
Yeah,
there.
Nice.
My family's not privileged. My dad died when I was young, and I was one of the kids who had to get the free school meals, you know, and couldn't have things, and it was a difficult childhood, actually. And when I think about my journey and how I started out, I think I always care about things, and I feel very privileged that in my life, I'm always interested in something outside of myself, which I think has helped me in this journey. And so I was very inspired. Well, I guess when I started my journey in terms of feeling I could do something like what I've ended up doing, although I didn't know it then, was just, you know, volunteering and getting involved in I was a young mother. I got married very young and I had three children. I was volunteering at the school to help, going in the school. And I realized, you know, oh, I can sort of get things started, do things myself. I'd always cared about nature. I remember that as a kid, thinking, oh, animals, seeing the circus go by, and I'm thinking, oh, animals shouldn't be in cages, and hearing trees being cut down and thinking, that's not right. So I guess in terms of a leadership thing, it was sort of acting on my feeling that this wasn't right and something had to be changed. So I started out volunteering for organizations like Greenpeace, raising a lot of money, helping with their campaigns alongside the school volunteering. Then thought, I want to start a green business because it's this terrible impact that our lifestyles are having on the planet. And what right have we got to chop all the trees down for some paper things that we then throw away and take away the habitat for nature. So I think in terms of leadership, that gives me a lot of strength because it's not about me, it's about the issue. As I got started, I thought, oh, well, I want to create a green business, and what can I do? And I was actually working at an environmental charity as an information officer part-time. And I started developing so many things outside of what was supposed to be my job that the woman who ran it said, you should go and start up your own organisation. Off you go. And at the time, I thought that was a bit harsh. I did. And I co-founded BioRegional with Purin Desai. I think it was good to have someone else there, gives you a bit more courage, although we were very brave, but having someone else to, you know, just talk things over with. So we started our own organization, and what I found was that if you have a vision, people sort of gather around an idea. So the initial ideas were around, there was a big recycled paper mill nearby, how can we recycle our paper to the paper mill and get it back again, and, you know, reduce our footprint and that impact on those forests. And you just, you know, I'd found just talking to people, and people collect around an idea and collect around you and want to see it succeed. And that has been happened time after time after time after time. If you can sort of see something good, people gather around it. So I think people have always said to me that they like the authenticity. So I think also being true to yourself and what you are passionate about has been something that has led to this journey and this wonderful life and these interesting things that I've done. Just so I'd always say to everyone in the audience, you know, that's my recommendation.
When you say authenticity, because when we talked and you asked Mariana, why you reached out to me? And then I said, Sue, because I thought it was very inspiring how you walk the talk, or you try to walk the talk. And when we met, I had the chance to visit your house and see the, you said like as an eco village or a more passive house and all these aspects, which I think is very inspiring to our work too, because I think we are always asking ourselves which impact we generate and whether we are applying the things we do. You know? So I see that very much, very much in you and your work and your life. So thanks. Thanks also for highlighting that. Rhino, is this a part where you also felt you'd like to share a bit about your experience or something interesting about your path?
Yeah, sure. Happy to do that. So what I did not mention in my introduction is that I spent the biggest part, largest part, longest part of my professional life outside of the NGO sector, actually in the IT industry, in a very different company. Started off in Hewlett Packard, and they have a specific leadership style. And then like 12 years later, I joined EMC. Totally different company, totally different leadership style. And that was definitely a learning for me. Work for a company and then also in leadership positions, first in Hewlett Packard, very rich history. They really shaped the IT industry. And then around the year 2000, they pretty much started their journey going south, not in the sense of going globally south, but going down. The merger with Compaq, for those of you who are old enough to remember these days, that was then clearly something where something broke in the organization. A totally different leadership style came in. It became quite apparent for me how the logic, the rationale, also the psychology of the leader actually has an influence on the success of an organization. And then joining EMC, which was kind of a classical US company driven by shareholder value, hire and fire approach, really cutthroat business, but quite successful. So there were very successful for many, many years, decades almost, and only then. So for me, it was interesting to see how even within the commercial sector, different leadership styles apply and what works and what does not work. And then my assumption moving over into the NGO sector was that, okay, everybody would align behind the objectives of the organization and it would be a lot easier and it would be a lot kind of, you don't have to convince people. You don't have to permanently push and drive people because there would be this intrinsic motivation. Far from that. That was kind of, if you ask for, so what did I learn? My key learning there was in the NGO sector, the leadership challenge is at least as big as in the commercial sector. Quite often it's even bigger. And quite often one of the reasons why it is so complex, and to Sue's point, and I would totally, actually, kind of, I'm coming from a very, very different angle here, because you're doing it because you're convinced of it. And this conviction is actually sometimes from a leadership perspective, the key success, the key factor for not being successful, because everybody believes that they hold the truth. There's only one truth for them, but in CBM, like with 700 people, as I said, there's 700 different types of truth. People are super motivated. They are really giving everything they have, but they lose the distance. Sometimes they go too deep and then they burn themselves. They damage others around them and they damage the organization by being too intense. And that is something that I also had to learn, where I thought, okay, this is NGO sector is a little bit more relaxed, like this cutthroat IT business. It is not, but there's different, it's the same psychology, because it's all about humans in the organization and what drives them, but there are different trigger points, and there is this tremendous intensity that actually makes it sometimes very, very difficult from a leadership point of view.
So you think these various visions that everybody has in the order of various, let's say, dreams or so within the one organization is inherited to the NGO sector and not necessarily to the organization as such? Because we could also think maybe it's the, I don't know, the freedom the organization gives or the bottom up or the flat hierarchy or so in the organization that might foster that.
No, I think I spent, before I joined CVM, I spent 8 years on the supervisory board of Greenpeace in Germany. So one of the larger Greenpeace chapters. And I saw very similar things. Now with hindsight, it's always easier to think about it. But one of these guys, actually, the fundraiser in Greenpeace, he said once to me, and it took me really years, and then also my time in CVM to understand in the full breadth of what he meant, these idealistic associations, these idealistic organizations are the worst. And I thought, whoa, that is kind of a very strong statement. And I would say he was right, because these organizations are, and that is not just because of CVM. CVM and Greenpeace, very different ways how we work. But that point is definitely true for these two organizations and for other organizations that I have seen as well.
Thanks, Heiner. Looking to Helen, Wolfgang, Wilhelm, I'm happy to move on to our next question. But if you're itching to share something about your personal experience, Sue, I also see you raising hands, so we can still do that before we move on.
Well, I'm just digesting what Rainer says, you know.
Well, I can give an example on that point, because I think one of the issues comes when you're trying to do something, you know, like an HR thing or a finance thing, and there's a kind of, you can't treat us like that. This is a nonprofit. And you're like, I'm still an employer. And I've run into that at all the organizations in the nonprofit sector. There's a kind of, somewhere I worked, it's like, we were going to make some people redundant because of austerity and funding cuts and stuff. And people are like, I don't want to work for an organization that would make someone redundant. I was like, well, good luck. Because, you know, you've still got to run the organization at the end. So I think that thing where, you know, you've got a lot of very committed people, broad value sets, and then maybe some idealism that somehow this is a different world. And you've got to bring that, but you've also got to run an organization as an organization at the end of the day. So, yeah, so just to Reiner's point, you can really run navigating stuff, which maybe in a corporate setting is very, yeah, there's less money, there are fewer people, you know, it becomes a whole different story.
Yeah, it's really cool to hear that, because we tend to think leaders as people also out there and enjoying this, as some of you already said before, maybe the power or being the boss. And you're being very transparent also about the challenges or the real life and in having to manage so many things, including, of course, and hopefully the vision, which is the heart of the whole thing. No?
I totally hear what you're saying. And there's a whole, in the social enterprise movement, there's a whole well-being movement just around that issue of burnout. And I've been lucky enough to join in with some of that as well myself and get the benefit of it. But I think how we counter that in our organisation is, yes, we are idealistic, but we also really place a high value on everyone who works his whole life and think about them. We have lunch together. We're very open. We talk about things, quite a flat hierarchy. And so that seems to balance it out. And it's one of the main things that people say if they ever move on, which people obviously do, is that that's what they love about working here, but it's quite a caring place. And I think that's a part of leadership as well, really caring about people. If I saw someone who's burning themselves out, I'll be saying, let's take some time off. Let's get another member of staff, you know, really paying attention to that, because you're so right, it is a big issue in the movement, but it can be tackled.
You might have heard about a couple of difficult situations in organizations that are highly value driven. You know, the Amnesties of this world, you know, where you have a lot of kind of passion, political clout, the cause, you know, and these are highly impactful and incredibly important organizations, but they're incredibly difficult to manage for that reason. I mean, you have the intrinsic motivation there, you have the drive, the power, everything that you want in an organization, and at the same time, first of all, it's not always going in the same direction. And secondly, what we heard from, for instance, from Amnesty, and to a certain extent, from one or two other organizations in the sector, is that the drive, the passion, the truth that you seem to have, you know, sometimes prevents you from making compromises, from treating each other in a more forgiving way than you're treating, for instance, the people you're trying to fight politically. So the fight against the outside world kind of gets continued in the inside world. And when you have a less value-driven environment, like in the corporate sector or in some of the organizations that are more about, you know, delivering services, there's the likeliness that the management becomes a little bit easier, but also there's the likeliness that you are less impactful. I mean, there's such a fine balance, you know, to getting it right. And maybe a last point, I've read an interesting kind of study on sustainable leadership in the corporate sector. And that was just commissioned by Russell Reynolds, one of the big kind of headhunting firms, and it's out in the public and there's no secrets in there. Only that I think this kind of value base, the drive for sustainability in the corporate sector becomes bigger and bigger. And it becomes bigger also for the leaders of those sectors too. So to a certain extent, they're not just reacting to what the customers and the clients want from them, but also what their own staff and their own organizations want them for them. So this sector is not immune from this kind of very delicate balance.
Can I just add really quickly, because this is actually the core of what we do. And we work with Amnesty in the Thailand office. We've worked with them for some years and have seen some shift. We work with corporate as well, international corporate teams and things like that. So big and small and NGO and not. And the leadership component of that is hugely important for sure. As far as I've worked with some groups where we do some wonderful work with them, it's great, but then the leader is the one who doesn't take it on. And when the leader doesn't take it on, back to that authenticity, it doesn't work. At the same time, what you're breaking, what you're fighting is behavior change, it's social change, it's how we think about what we do and why we do it and who we are. And there's a lot of guilt wrapped up in it. There's a lot of elements to it. It's certainly one of the big, I think, issues coming. And since COVID, more people are recognizing that, oh, hey, this is actually important stuff we should be thinking about. There's a lot of business case for resilience and well-being, both for corporate and NGO, international NGOs and local NGOs, all of it around. But this is, I just wanted to jump in because this is the core of a lot of what we do. And we work with some of these groups that you're talking about. So it's a delicate balance and it's a big change from everything we've ever believed about how we work, how we relate to each other and what we do.
Cool, Jen. Thank you. Moving on then to our next topic. We are talking about leadership here and then we are curious to then see and hear how do you exactly define a good leadership? So a good leader. And Helen, looking to you coming next, if you'd like to share some thoughts, what do you think about that and which skills or which attributes would you highlight as of someone being a good leader?
Yeah, I don't know if I have, it's one of those things with good leadership, kind of, you know it when you see it, which is really annoying for people who are like, what's the key? And I think, people have raised that authenticity point. So I don't think it's authenticity at the expense of skills, because I'm obsessed with podcasts where like things got, you know, companies that go off the rails. I love those. So, you know, we crashed, the story of WeWork, that's a good listen. And those, and then the whole thing about, you know, the Fire Festival and things like that. So I do enjoy a bit of leadership schadenfreude, let's call it that, but where, you know, it's just about the vision and it's just about, this is what I want. And if you look in the mirror and beat your chest, you know, you can do it. And I that's not true. And for me, it's about, and I think Wolfgang said this earlier, about not, you know, trying to put your ego. So the good news I think are where the ego is left at the door. Something you've got to have an ego, because you've got to know that in the right moment you can make a decision. I think, you know, being able to make a decision, but also building the team around you. And, you know, I had a bit of a big moment. You asked about big moments or something. I had a ages ago, I was running a half marathon, which sounds very show-offy, but I was going very slowly. I was going with a friend and I had an injury, and he worked in HR and did like HR, like recruiting, really high-end jobs like finance directors and stuff. And I was like, how do you do your job? Recruitment's the worst bit of my job. I hate it. And he's like, recruitment as CEO is the most important part of your job. You've got to think about your job as being assembling a really good team and letting them do really well. And I was like, I hadn't thought of it like that. And over the course of the following 2 hours, because it took us a long time to run this thing, he'd really just changed my mind about kind of, it's not about doing it all yourself. It's about figuring out who's good at what, putting that in place, enabling others, and how you create. For me, it's about that enabling environment, but also knowing when you need to step in and how you do that. So, you know, I think a lot of these things have raised already, but not having like a, for me, it's not like, here is the fixed version of me, but trying to build on the skills that you bring to it and knowing what skills you don't have and what skills others need to bring.
Just because Helen mentioned now about, for example, also team building. Wilhelm, when we talked, you said you are very involved on bringing the team members to Govinda, and that recruitment part is something that you value and you are involved with. I was wondering if you'd like to share any thoughts on this, about what do you think is, what do you think makes a person a good leader, and this aspect of team building?
Yeah, well, as we heard, there's a lot of around like 700 kinds of leaders. I would summarize it a little bit like a good leader is, that was I always hoping when I was working, that my leader would see my potential and my skills and put me in that part where I could work nicely. So for me, it is like a good leader would be a person who sees the skills and abilities of others and put them then in the right positions. I would summarize it a little bit like that.
Rainer, over to you then.
Yeah, building on what Helen said, because I really like the kind of this questioning of the authenticity of one of these very strange
perfect
discussions, and then also incorporating Wilhelm's comment, because I think sometimes, and also here, and it's kind of natural that we're doing it, is the focus on the leader is actually the wrong focus for any leadership discussion. And I'm saying that because the focus, when we think about leadership, the focus should be those who are being led. And that is, like Wilhelm just used different words, but said the same. And he says, I expect from my leader that the leader focuses on me, looks at me, and then adjusts potentially leadership style, looking at my skills, incorporating these and building the team in the best way. But true leadership, and I'm struggling with the term good leadership, that has a normative element in that. So I'd rather start with effective leadership. And effective leadership is if you're able to influence the behavior of those you are leading. And that kind of turns the perspective totally around. You look at those who are being led first, and then the leader has to adjust. So typically we say there is the leader, and then everybody else has to adjust. And that, but that's not how the life actually works. It's the other way around. The leader has to be flexible and adjust style so that the leader can actually get the best out of those who are in the team. So we need to have this change of perspective. We need to look at what is effective leadership. And we have to admit in the NGO sector that sometimes those who we don't like at all are actually effective leaders, because they are able to actually achieve something. We think it's all crap that they're achieving, but that's a different discussion. So the first question needs to be, what is effective leadership? And only once we clarify that, then we can look at, and what is the quality of being good in that leadership? And that's where the values come in. And that's where we can say, this is how we should, kind of, this is what we want to achieve with this effective leadership.
That sounds provocative, and yeah. So I'm curious to see if there are other considerations among the panelists, among our speakers, about that.
Yeah, I'd like to challenge that a bit. Yeah. I mean, obviously the distinction is understandable, but I think in the sector we're working in, I think good leadership, this normative element, you know, you cannot think away. Yes, there's effective leaders out there, you know, who are not good or don't have something good in mind. I don't even care about this, frankly. You know, I think we're talking within a context where you cannot distinguish good leadership from effective leadership. And it's a tricky one, I agree, because I think you can, some of the discussions that we have about leadership very often maneuver around, okay, what makes you the right type of leader? You know, it has to do with yourself. You know, we talked about how close it has to be to certain characteristics. You know, you need to be curious, you need to be courageous. I mean, we've heard a little bit from Jen and Helen when they talked about their journey, and you can see some of that, I think, which is very common, I think, surely amongst the people on the panel here, but many others as well. You need to be able to, you know, to take risks, to fail, to carry heavy loads. But I think there's always that additional element, I think, that we need to consider, that there is a normative. Rainer would probably not have moved to the NGO sector out of the corporate sector if that normative element wouldn't have been there. So I think also the type of leadership that you're exercising is determined both by, you know, the right type of qualities and the normative piece. And maybe a second piece that comes into play here, besides the personal characteristics, is the context we're in. You know, we have a context that is determined by the teams we're leading. Yes, you know, I'm completely with Willem and others. You know, this determines a huge part of being a good or effective leader. This needs to resonate with the team. And by the way, you know, we have very different teams in very different organizations. I changed organizations 4 or 5 times over my 15 years or so. And mind you, you know, every time I had to exercise different type of skills, engagement and the like. And there were a couple of interesting surprises out there for me as well. So the teams form one piece of the context. And then the other piece of the context is the work environment, or the environment that we are all working in. You know, how is it determined? Does it call for, you know, the strong, powerful, move ahead, you know, hit your chest leader? Or does it call for someone who's asked to stabilize a situation? Does it call for someone who manages a crisis like Corona? So this kind of environment also matters a lot. So what does that lead to? I mean, I don't have very good kind of recipes, but I think the ability to adjust and be agile to those different circumstances matters a lot. And then, you know, people talked about authenticity. Yes, you know, you can only bring what you have. And there's no way, you get nowhere if for a longer time you try to pretend to be someone else.
Wolfgang, if we could continue a little bit more with you to reflect on a connected topic that we talked about when we had our preparation talk. You said something to me that I thought was very interesting. You said, Mariana, leadership has been also changing over time. So if we could discuss a little bit about how this has been changing.
Yeah, just very shortly. I mean, first of all, I think a couple of things have stayed the same. I mean, I always enjoyed kind of reading leadership theories, you know, the stuff that Kotter wrote in the 90s, and you come up with different types of leadership theories. And while I don't think any of them has the recipe for us, I think it's usually helpful to reflect on what people have written down on leadership theories. Now, there's a couple of very recent or current kind of leadership theories or approaches. Feminist leadership is a very strong kind of approach in the current situation, and that applies to women and men. So it is definitely an interesting approach to understand better. And the sustainable leadership is maybe the other big thing that is out there. What does that mean concretely? What I've experienced is that there's a few things that have significantly changed. There's more transparency and participation asked for. You know, this is an expectation towards our leaders in the sector. It makes leading more difficult, you know, to be participatory, to be very transparent, maybe not completely transparent, but I think it makes leading success much more sustainable. There's a couple of myths that are being kind of thrown through the window. A leader has to work 70 hours a day. A leader has to know it all. Sorry, not 70 hours a week, has to know it all. I mean, this kind of superpower leadership, I think this is also, you hardly find that anymore. And then, yes, there are many more women in leadership positions. I think it does make a difference to how leadership is being exercised and also what is being expected. So these are some of the trends that I'm seeing. what remains the same, it has to, you know, it has to reflect your own personality, and it has to reflect the context that we're in, what I said before.
This makes a very good transition to the next topic we wanted to discuss with you, possibly also a next controversial topic, which is this aspect of women leadership or feminist leadership. So when we discuss some of the questions we wanted to talk about today, we said, what are the differences between women and men leadership? And this question has prompted a lot of interesting conversations in our bilateral calls. I liked it a lot. So a little bit of disclaimer first before we open the floor to hear your opinion. So we are particularly, so it's not our goal here to say men are naturally one way, women are naturally another way. The goal here is really to see, are there particular challenges that maybe women face or that men face in being leaders? Or are there particular learnings or opportunities, again, from women or men that we can realize? And if there are barriers and opportunities, why is it so? What's behind that? And so hopefully by unfolding that, we can learn something from that process. So act upon those challenges or those opportunities. Mm-hmm. Helen, when we talked, I think
I get quite exercised about it.
Yeah. So floor is yours.
Well, I don't know about other, you know, I've been in the environmental bit of the NGO world for a while, and there's a bit of a discourse that somehow women are more equipped to care for the environment because, you know, we've got uteruses or whatever, that then somehow that will make us care for planet Earth. And it really annoys me. And it annoys me on behalf of men as well as women. Because I just think, and you said, like, we're not going to get into men of this, women of that. I think that's right. But a lot of people do, and they kind of essentialize it. And there's a kind of, you know, and I think it's going to be really interesting post-COVID, because there was a meme going around earlier before everyone was getting it wrong. It was like, oh, women are handling this better. And I was like, it's quite interesting. And is how's that going to play out kind of thing. But what I do think is true, and it's interesting, Wolfgang mentioned feminist leadership, and maybe I should read up on this, because I'm not very good at reading leadership books. I sort of sometimes buy them and then I sort of put them on a shelf and think that's probably, you know, enough. But I do think the way that, I'm going to put it in this terms, that sort of my generation and probably a generation before, the way that women have been socialized, I think might give us skills that, to the skills that we just talked about there, and what makes for good leadership, that in that sense, what people are saying about women as good leaders is actually being forced to listen, being forced to not have an ego through sort of social skills that we've been made to foster. So I think there might be something there that's interesting. And I'm interested as that situation improves in terms of how younger people are brought up and maybe are socialized differently, that we'll come to another thing, and then we can get back more to the kind of, what are the skills that you need? So I keep going back to that kind of skills point. But yeah, particularly in climate, I get very, I mean, relatedly annoyed when people sort of talk about the climate from, you know, I'm doing this for my kids. It's like, come on, you should do it because it's what we have to do and we need to save the planet. And it's sort of endlessly pushing it onto other people or things, you know, that sort of gets to me, and the kind of women in the environment sort of plays into that. So yeah, I'm really interested to hear from how others have reacted to this, because I, as you see, I have a strong reaction. In terms of, you did say one thing, which is like, what are the challenges that maybe different people face? I'm sure everyone has different, you know, that thing where someone explains your job to you. I don't know if that happens to men as much as it happens to women. I'd love to hear if it does, but you know, where I went to a dinner and it was quite a high level dinner. So I don't know what they thought I was doing there. And this person sort of turned to me and went, well, you know, there's this, I've just discovered today about recycling, and then went on a 15 minute, and I was like, I run a climate NGO. I think I've probably come across this notion. Anyway, I'll leave it there. And I don't know how much that happens to others.
Thanks, Helen. Yeah, I think one thing we both realized when we talked to Helen is that those differences might tell more about society and how we are raised and about essential differences between men and women. So maybe some of those skills that we appreciate on one or on the other, we could just socialize to everybody on the same way. You know? Thoughts, who would like to share thoughts or insights or comments on this?
That was very validating. Thank you, Helen. That made me feel better. In terms of, I think, in the past, I've sometimes had people around where I like to discuss everything with the team, hear what people think about things. Not really, I'll say what I think, but I don't I actually want to hear from the team because everyone's got different perspectives and skills and we play different roles. And if one goes out of the team, someone else might take on that role of being the cynic. I really feel Raina's taking on a role here in this panel group, for example, of sort of being a bit challenging and thought provoking, which is great. And so I guess that, and I've been criticized for, well, why just can't you just tell us what we've got, you know, just tell us how it's going to be and don't take so long to make up your mind, you're indecisive. And I don't think it takes a long time and I don't think it's indecisive. I think it's about making good decisions in a timely fashion, having discussed it with a few people. But I think that's seen as, I've been criticized for that, but I just defend myself and why it's a good idea. I've also, in terms of challenges, I've also found, you know, look at me, I look quite sort of nice, like somebody's mum. And there are a lot of people who still don't see women as equal, unfortunately. And you really do notice the difference when you're with a group of people who respect people equally, whoever they are and whatever age they are, you know, they're listening to what they say. But I do also find that sometimes people overlook me and just turn to a man who's with me, who might not be as experienced or knowledgeable as me, but they'll hear what a man says. But in terms of leadership, that can be a bit of a blow because then you think, oh, you know, I've lost the room here because how can I lead when I'm not being taken seriously?
Wilhelm, you wanted to say something before. Go ahead.
Yeah, just the personal experience the last 30 years, of course, when you work in the organic market, you have a lot of women, ladies as a company leader, especially. I was just thinking about it in Scandinavia with those companies we work, almost all the CEOs are ladies. I don't know if something has to do with the Scandinavia, but otherwise my experience is actually, I don't see a much really big difference by experience. It's just more two things. Women are more humor. They have more humor. That's my experience. And they're more creative. That's from my personal experience. Maybe it has to do with organic food, I don't know, but that's my experience. Otherwise, I don't see much difference.
Cool, and interesting that you highlighted that in your sector, you feel there are more or various women leaders, and that's interesting to hear. Raina, you wanted to go?
Yeah, just emphasizing Sue's point, coming from the kind of male perspective here, but Sue, you're totally right. For whatever reason, and I observe this as well, that sometimes way too often I see it that women are not being taken seriously. I haven't really figured out why is that, and potentially it's education, socializing, whatever, but that's really the thing where we struggle. I don't know if feminist leadership is a concept that will take us out of that. To a certain degree, my fear is that feminist leadership, because it drives the discussion into a specific direction, actually might be distracting from the real topic. I've discussed with many women now because I wanted to understand what is feminist leadership, and I still haven't fully understood my feeling, because the elements of feminist leadership that they could explain to me, going back to leadership literature, that's all been there. So it's a lot about participation. And like decades ago, 50 years ago, it was this discussion about these three or four leadership styles, and participatory leadership was already there. So it's not really innovative. What I have taken away from these discussions really is kind of standard elements just mixed together in a new format, not even in a consistent and coherent way, depending on the organization and depending on the author of feminist leadership literature. For me, the key thing is the diversity element, always having the odd one out in the team. I heard that about how they manage that in Israel in the army, where when they have a team of 10, there's always one person defined. And I don't know if it's true, maybe it's just kind of a nice story, but they always have one who is forced to play to have the different opinion. Background for this is the war on Yom Kippur. Because at that point, the Israelis could not imagine that they would be attacked on Yom Kippur. And that's why they lost. That's why they actually got into deep trouble and then had to recover from that. But they had this groupthink of this is not going to happen. And that's why they said this groupthink must not happen again. So it's the diversity element, the different opinion that I want to have in my team. Sometimes that's annoying, and sometimes I don't want to have that, but that is what we have to cope with as leaders. So for me, this discussion about feminist leadership is not going in the right direction. It's more diversity, making sure that we get different types of people into the room. And then obviously that starts with a balance of male and female leaders in the team.
Okay, so going to our last round, I think we were all very curious to hear if you have a tip or one learning that you would share with us to motivate us to exercise leadership, or if it's not leadership as such, but this drive for us to move forward with our passions. And the reason why we are asking for this tip is, I think most of us that feel like to do something new or take a new step in life might be feel afraid of that and feel we are not good enough or we are not there yet in order to take that next step or to dare and feel that we might not be accepted by others or we are not seen as leaders by others. So in this sense, this holds us back and we are maybe just not daring to take the next step. So once again, just recapping the question is, what would be your one tip or suggestion or learning that you tell us in order to motivate us to then go forward with our dreams and our passions? Jen, I think you particularly liked that question. So would you like to start?
Sure. I want to go back to the fear thing just a little bit, because we often wait. I'll do it when I'm ready. I'll do it when I'm confident. I'll do it when I feel like I can. I'll do it when other people already think I can do it. Then we never do it, because you'll never be ready. You'll always feel that you're lacking. You'll always feel maybe that you're not enough. Maybe that you could be better, a little better. That's what holds a lot of people back from doing really great things that they have in mind. And the key for this, one of the keys that I found is that that's all of us. There's nobody on this earth that does not have something inside of them saying at some point, you're not good enough. That's not you. You didn't make it yet. You're not ready. Are you sure? And I have examples of this in my life where people who are at the top of their field and you talk to them at some point. One guy at the top of his field, recognized internationally, been at the top of his field for years. This is the guy. He was being complimented about something and I looked at his face and he was very uncomfortable. As he came out of the meeting room and I said, hey, I know him very well. And I said, how are you doing? Like, how was that? He said, I keep waiting for them to realize I don't know what I'm doing. And I thought, this guy is recognized internationally as the guy. And he's still seeing himself as in his brain is sitting at the kids' table eating, right? Looking at the adults' table, waiting to get up there. It's not there. And I thought, man, if he's thinking that, I'm thinking that, this is normal. And then the more you talk to people who are open about these sorts of things, the more you realize it's everybody. Good friend of mine, she's leads an international company, massive. And she was going for a new job with another massive international company, you all know, even higher leadership level. And she said, do you think I can do it? And I thought, you're the exact person to do this. You can do this so well. But even people who are at those levels, you might look at and think, oh, they've made it. We all have it inside of us that saying, no, you're not ready. You're not good enough. That's not you. Somebody will find out eventually. You don't know what you're doing, or you're just winging it. That's life. We're all winging it. So for me, once you accept that, and then you say, okay, if it excites you and it scares you, you should probably do it. So do it anyway. With, as Helen, you were saying, all the skills. You can't just run out there without any of the skills or anything like that, right? So you skill up and you do the thing. And then you surround yourself with support. So we talked about how leadership is lonely because you have no peers anymore. You can't go chatting with your colleagues about what's going right or wrong because you have no colleagues. You have team and then there's you. You have to surround yourself with your own peers, people you find, people you gather to help you through these moments that you're feeling like, can I do it? Can I not do it? To keep you honest, to keep you going. Not all at once necessarily, but people that you can easily talk to keep it going. And that's something that we have to be intentional about doing because it doesn't just happen. A lot of people I work with are in leadership levels and then they go, what do I do now? I don't know who to talk to. And we have this conversation a lot. Or how do I overcome my inner demons, because our own worst enemy is ourselves. There's so much you can do if you accept the fact that you will never be ready.
So hearing, listening to you, I would say just start, just give it a go. You're probably never going to feel 100% ready, and surround yourself with peers or persons that you trust for trusted, being a trusted sparring partner, let's say. No?
You will feel it the most when you're doing exactly what you're supposed to be doing. That's a next step. That's when you feel it the most. You don't feel it when you're cruising. You feel it when you're challenging yourself and taking the step you need to take.
Love it. Thanks, Jen.
Ryan. Can I just build on that, because it just fits in so nicely, Jen, because you're absolutely right with everything that you said that is perfect. The only thing that I would add is, so just repeating the core, you need to be ready to do things that you are not prepared for. And that will include that you will fail. You will make mistakes and you will fail. So what the only piece that I would add to this is resilience. If you then give up, if you make a mistake, if you fail and then you give up, then it was just not worth it even to start with it. So that's what you have to bring in then, resilience, make mistakes, fall down, and then stand up again. Because as a leader, you will not stay on top. You will always have this feeling of, and now I totally screwed up. And now I did the big mistakes. Nobody loves me anymore. Then you have to have this resilience of, okay, I'm still going to do it because it is in line with my values and because it is important what I do here. And that's why I'm going through with it. And that's why I'm not giving up. So this resilience piece is really important, I believe.
Sue?
I feel like this is my last chance to say anything. So something I really want to say. I feel there's something really important about, we're all working in sustainability or for a better world, right? And we have to be as ambitious as we feel kind of motivated to be. And it does take you outside of your comfort zone. And I do remember as a kid, literally jumping in the deep end to learn to swim. I remember doing that. And I think you have to be ready to jump in the deep end, and it is a bit uncomfortable, but it's also interesting and exciting. And I never think that I'm the one that's going to be sorting it out. In terms of leadership, it's almost like curiosity to start talking to people. So, for example, going and working at the UN, we'd never done that. I just felt I've got to take these great examples of how we can do sustainability and talk to the diplomats at the UN, because there's this Rio Plus 20 sustainable development process going on. And I didn't know what I was doing. So a key thing I wanted, two key points I'm trying to make here are about, well, maybe three. Stepping right up, because we need it right now. You know, don't be a shrinking violet. Come on, everyone. We're all in this together. And then working in teams, and especially where there's something going on. So that leadership from within, being part of a team where you've let go. It's not about your organisation. It's about the issue, and being in a team and showing leadership within a team and speaking up for what's right. That's leadership. And you know, going away and doing your homework with humility and helping these decision makers to do what they want to do. And that was a way that I found of using some leadership in a process like that. And I just want to exhort everyone that it's not just about your organization, it's about system change. And we've all got to pull together now and show leadership for changing systems before we completely destroy the planet and everyone on it. That was quite big. But I just feel like, come on, everyone, step up.
Thank you. So, Wolfgang?
So if I may, because I really like Sue's statement. You see, I think we need many, many, many leaders in the sector, but we don't need many, many CEOs, directors, whatever. So I think leadership is really, I think it's an attitude. It's a way of working. It's not a position. And yes, I mean, if you're on your career path, if you're on your personal development path, I'm cautious about giving advices, but I think that one you need to get clear, you know. If you go for a position, which is legitimate, right? I mean, some people like leading a company or an organization or, you know, whatever. You need to be prepared for something that is more than just a leadership attitude. It is carrying stuff, heavy loads, you know, going risks, failing, carrying some of the stuff that Jen has talked about, you know, having to fail and not being able to tell anyone. So there is something that you need to, I think, that you need to be aware of before you say, okay, this is the way I'm going to go. On the other hand, if you're in a leadership position and not in a leadership attitude, or maybe both, I think what is a good idea is to stay as healthy as possible. So Rainer talked about resilience and the robustness. Yes, you know, we all know what it takes, healthy lifestyles and the like. But another good advice of this coach was, you know, when I was in a very difficult situation in my leadership position, he says, listen, what you go home every evening, and on your way home, you count the 10 things that went really well today. And I said, what, 10 things? No way. And of course it did work. So there's so much that you're able to effect and proceed and make progress on, you know. I think it's something that works pretty well about all the load that you're carrying. So try to exercise this.
Thanks, Wolfgang. Wilhelm, to you.
Oh, I just want to add a saying from that word that was just said by the others. It's saying that it's better to make a mistake who makes you humble instead that you're successful, become arrogant.
I like it.
So don't afraid about mistakes.
And I think that's something that really scares, I mean, most of us. I can also say for myself. I think this makes all the whole transition and this whole leadership exercise very human. If we are ready to accept that we are not, that you are not making wins all the time. No? And then that's part of the development and the learning, like Wilhelm just said. Thank you. Helen, would you like to
suggest something? Building on that as well, one thing that I think is really underrated is apologizing. So I'm just going to throw that in there, like a good heartfelt apology. People do not do that enough, and it's something you should think about. And then I suppose in terms of tips, and people have mentioned in passing sort of coaches and mentors, and I suppose it's that thing of like, you're not like the idea of born a leader. It's not, no, you know, get help and think. And it's about coaching is all about being helped to do things more consciously, right? And sort of thinking about what you're doing and then trying to apply it. And I don't have a coach, actually I don't have a coach right now. I don't have one all the time. I haven't had, but I've sort of had coaches for a bit and they're not, but you know, and quite often, because you need to absorb what they've told, you know, what they've helped you think about and put that into practice. And I had a coach, we had a big issue at work a couple of years ago. And my coach said to me, what do you think leadership looks like in this situation? And it was such a useful thing to like, put yourself to one side, think about what you think leadership is for this, and then figure out how you're gonna get to that. That was a useful exercise. I always come back to that question when something's a bit difficult. It's like, what? It's almost like, well, what would a real leader do? Okay, well, maybe I could do that. It's kind of, again, taking yourself out of the situation. But I think coaches are all about those powerful questions, or good ones are, rather than telling you what to do. It's like, how do you give yourself a toolkit for figuring stuff out?
Thanks, everyone. I think now it's time for us to open the floor to our participants as well. So I see we started having questions in the chat, but we're also open for comments. This is a dialogue. Johanna sent a question and she was also supported by a couple of other participants. So Johanna, if you'd like to introduce yourself and say your question out loud, that would be great.
My question was, can please give examples of mistakes that you have actually made and what you learned from it? We have a proverb in Finnish that says something like that, to make a mistake is to receive a gift, but I never hear like concrete examples of these nice gifts that you get.
Thanks, Johanna. Sue, okay, go ahead.
I'll volunteer a mistake. I feel it's almost like it's like a slight judgment thing rather than, oh, it was a massive mistake. But recently during COVID, we had to furlough, so put on leave a lot of our staff. I didn't speak up enough. I could feel it was going wrong and too many people were off and others were struggling. And I should have spoken up more, but I let our head of finance and I won't name too many names, but a couple of people who are maybe a bit better at sort of managing things efficiently to override my instinct that we got to be a bit more human here and we're putting too much pressure on people. And then later on, a colleague said, oh, you're like the canary in the coal mine. And my chair of the board said, yeah, make sure you speak up next time. And actually that was something I learned on the wellbeing project, to speak up more, which maybe links to what Helen was saying about being conditioned to not speak up. you know, and that I love having a team discussion, and then I feel a bit awkward if I have to push something through, and I should have pushed it through, even though that, and it just went on a few weeks too long. And I've got a project mistake, which was tried to do something really difficult and then kept it going way too long, and I should have just canned it. It was a big drain on everyone.
Thanks, Sue. Would anybody else like to share one thing that you consider as being maybe a mistake or a learning opportunity?
Sure, I'll go for that. I'll give you two. I'll give you a personal one and a management one. Personal one, at one point I was applying for a job. They had a manager position and a staff position, and I was young. I could do both. The management would have been the next step for me. They said, we haven't filled either position. We could consider you for both. Which one should we consider you for? This is the part where I was supposed to say the manager, of course, but I didn't. And I thought, oh, this is a new project. They have this hierarchical system. It's like male dominated. I'm really young. I'm not going to be the person who's going to be able to shepherd this project to success. And I said, the staff position, which was a mistake, because the boss I got was not that much older than me, then mentally, psychologically harassed me for the year that she was in her position, and I still did all the work anyway. So for me, the lesson is don't ever undersell yourself. When you can do it, but it's a stretch, then go for that. The professional one was I had a staffing situation where, let's just say there were those hints that some staff were going a bit sour. And actually what happened is I had a team of staff who were trying to get me fired. And that was in the end, I realized that was what was happening. But let's say, just like Sue, I let that go too long before I made decisive action. And I tried to do little things and sort of help them to adjust. But actually, they were just out for my demise. That's it. They just wanted me out. They wanted to control their boss, and they couldn't control me. So in the end, I controlled them, and they didn't work for me anymore. But I was also working for an organization, Helen, that would not let me fire anyone, because NGOs don't do that. So I ended up having to restructure the office and thereby eliminating their jobs and rewriting the whole structure unnecessarily. But we got some good out of it, so that I could fire them without firing them. I'm seconding Ellen's challenges about we still have to run an organization here. And my mistake in that was I let it go too long, so that it became a more of a crisis situation when it could have been less of a crisis situation.
If you still want to go on the mistakes, I had run a bit like that. I used to work for Médecins Sans Frontières, so, you know, aid agency in the field, and I'm not medical, but I was managing a doctor, and the doctor was misbehaving. She was kind of okay as a doctor, but she was not for some other stuff. And so I was having these ongoing problems with her, and I remember my boss saying, you know, have you given her a written warning? And I was like, no, I really feel like I've made a breakthrough. Like, I really feel like she's really like changing. And I think that if I write it down, she'll just revert. And then sure enough, like 2 weeks later, she did something completely outrageous. I needed to basically send her home, and the rest of the team, and she turned to the rest of the team, was like, well, I never had any warning about this. And so then I had a kind of team problem, because they're like, well, she, poor thing, she never had a warning. I was like, oh my God, I spoke to her weekly. And it was that real thing of like, when you let the, you sort of think you're better than the process, you think you know a bit better than process somehow. And again, that thing of like, this is a different environment and we do things differently here. And, you know, I've really got, and just knowing when it's going too long and actually just documenting some stuff might be painful, but it's gonna, there's a longer game. And I really learned from that, so.
Sorry, just want to show that men make mistakes too. So, I mean, obviously what just been shared has happened to all of us, you know, making mistakes around dealing with staff and also letting things go too long and maybe shunning away from a decision. Maybe the two other examples I want to share, one is what do you do when you make a mistake? I mean, in my case, I kind of often contradict myself, you know, in positive sense, shows my agility because I'm thinking different directions, but negatively, you know, when I give a clear direction 1 week and then the next week I come in another direction, my colleague tells me, listen, last week you told me the opposite. I think here, you know, you get into the embarrassment corner, or, you know, what do? You know, the person is right. And I think you need to admit, you need to take it with humor, you need to reflect on it, talk this through, no cover up, no whatever. So that's one piece. I think thinking about how do you deal with those situations. And then the second thing, I think and making mistakes is not always fun. I mean, sometimes it has dramatic consequences when you're leading an organization or anything. I have to say some things happened when I overlooked something. You might think that something is going well in some kind of corner, which you don't give the attention to. And that's where the biggest danger is. You know, things develop in the wrong direction and you don't pay the attention, or you don't have this on the radar, or you assume someone is taking care of this. I think that's where bad things can happen. So I can only recommend, have your radar kind of working all the time.
Thanks, Wolfgang. Very cool. We could take one more comment or question from the floor. Rosa.
We are having a lot of interesting comments and ideas here on the side, but maybe Claudia, because you just put it on, and I think your question is quite interesting because it also a bit reflects the idea of the Academy of Change, which is an international program. So do you want to pose your question as well?
But I was just really curious as to your experiences leading across generations and cultures. I feel like especially now, we just have such an influx of new leaders coming in with the younger, but they have such interesting and different and diverse kind of values of the workplace. And I find myself sometimes kind of wondering to myself and kind of struggling a little bit, like how to balance that with maybe more traditional kind of views on leadership and productivity, even within the NGO work world.
But if we could hear at least one reaction to Claudia's very interesting question, and then we could wrap up.
Focusing very much, Claudia, on what you wrote there, the leading across generations and cultures, because you can make this a huge thing. And I know how I felt when I was fairly young, and then I had to, and in my team, I had a very senior person, and she used to be way above me, and then reorganization, all of a sudden she was in my team. And I really struggled and thought about, so what do I do now? How can that work? My learning out of that is the same with intercultural communication and leading across cultures. If you focus on the person, if you don't think so much about, so where was kind of the hierarchical difference, or is different culture, if you focus on, so this is a human being, and for all human beings, they need very similar things. And that is being attentive to them, listen carefully, watch for their needs, and don't go in as a know-it-all and I tell you now. That actually works with nobody. Forget about culture. And it's always the same. And if you go in and teach and tell, people will shy away. And that is clearly one of my learnings. I thought, intercultural communication, yes, there are issues because we have different backgrounds, but there are these kind of standard things that are always right or always wrong in any culture and across any generation. So sometimes I think, let's not make it too big, just be human, attentive, and be respectful to everybody else. And then it typically works.
Thanks, Rainer. Jen, you'd still like to share a thought?
Can I just add right on top of that? I agree with being human, being respectful. At the same time, sometimes being respectful looks differently in different cultures. So I live in Thailand. I'm bilingual, so a lot of my work is in Thai. I do a lot of work across cultures, a lot of Asian cultures, and then Western cultures on top. There's one group I've worked with about 4 or 5 years, and their boss is a Western woman who is 60s. Let's say. So she's looking towards retirement. So it's both generational and cultural. Almost, so the other people in the management are mostly Western men of different ages. And then all the staff is Thai and mostly 30s and under. And when I first met this group, they were frustrated. They were not effective. They were not performing. They weren't doing their work well at all. They were overwhelmed. They were not going to hit their targets, nothing. And so we started to unpack a lot about that. And I worked with them as a group, and I also worked with the leader in a coaching situation as well. And we had to unpack, and she came with a lot of questions about, I've led groups before. Why is this different? than the other groups. And some of it was generational and some of it was cultural. And we had to have to delve in a little bit to how her staff were seeing her attempts to be respectful of them when actually it looked different in Thailand. They expected or they preferred to have her behave in a different way than she was used to in the places she worked before. And then also for the team itself, because the team is not homogenous, even though they're all Thai, but they all have their own backgrounds too. And they all have their own experiences. They all have their struggles and their assumptions about what work is like in an international organization. So we had to work out some of that. We had to work out some of the, where are the tension points, where are the not tension points? And we didn't necessarily go through the, well, Asians are like this, because again, there's so much diversity with each individual, but it was more of, this is a general flow. This is what you observe. So what Rainer was saying about observing what's going on and listening to what the team wants or the individual wants and how they're responding to what different things are going on. Now, they're very high performing. They're about to close our project and they've overshot all of their targets, which is great. I'm really happy for them. But it took a lot of work and a lot of attention, intention, and everyone working from the desire to see each other as a human being, as Rainer said, and also to just work together to do the thing, as Sue was saying, let's come together and do this thing.
Cool, Jen, thank you. Wilhelm, you wanted to say something and then we close?
Yeah, it's just a small comment. What I got to experience some weeks ago with the new style of business and leadership, I didn't hear that before. And he had, he's a friend, he had around 300 employees. He has like 15 vegan restaurants. And you can also say vegan restaurants without alcohol is almost like a non-profit business. And he's looking for leaders for the restaurants. And one of the criteria, I never heard that before, is he makes their astrological charts. He asking them before, they give allowance. And then the main criteria is he has a chart. You can see how selfish you are.
Okay.
And if you're, I don't know exactly the percentage, but if you're more than 75% selfish, then you're not qualified for the job. So you has to be to some part selfless. Yeah, selfless. So that's something like, I never heard that before. That's also a new time of
recruiting.
Recruiting leaders, just as a comment.
And as far as it can get. And then on that very nice note, I'd like to thank you all for joining us for today. I hope you enjoyed it as much as we did. I think it was really insightful. So thank you also to Wilhelm, Sue, Jen, Wolfgang, Rainer, and also to Helen. Thank you to you all for joining, sharing your comments and questions. I hope this is a first conversation, so a conversation starter that we can take forward in another opportunity or also bilaterally. So if you have more questions or comments, feel free to just also reach out to us, to me, and I take that forward also to connect our speakers.